Welcome, everybody. I'm going to introduce Mr. Edwin Black. He's a personal friend of mine for many years, and we've done some, let's call it Sephardic activism work together out west in California and here in New York and down in Washington. Edwin is an award-winning writer. He's written for the New York Times. He's a best-selling author. He's written... His books have come out in 80 different editions in 14 languages in 65 countries. He's been published by pretty much all the major leading newspapers and magazines in the U.S. and Europe, as well as Israel. With more than a million books in print, his work focuses on genocide and hate, corporate criminality and corruption, government misconduct, academic fraud, philanthropic abuse, oil addiction, alternative energy, and historical investigation. Edwin's books have been submitted for the Pulitzer Prize nomination 9 times. His 10 award-winning books include his blockbuster, IBM and the Holocaust, in 2001, British Petroleum and the Red Line Agreement, which just came out in 2011, The Farhood, which we're going to speak about tonight, which just came out last year, The Nazi Nexus, in 2009, The Plan in 2008, Internal Combustion 2006, Banking on Baghdad in 2004, War Against the Weak in 2003, and the Transfer Agreement in 1984. Edwin's received numerous major awards, including recently for his book Internal Combustion. He was honored as Best Book of the Year from the American Society of Journalists and Authors. He received the Rock Hour Award for Best Investigation of the Year from the American Jewish Press Association, as well as a Green Globe and the Thomas Edison Award. In 2003, he received the top 2 editorial awards from the American Society of Journalists and Authors. He won the Best Book of the Year for IBM in the Holocaust and Best Article of the Year for IBM in Auschwitz. That was in the Village Voice. Also in 2003, he received the International Human Rights Award from the World Affairs Council for his work in his book, War Against the Weak. Many of his books have been optioned by Hollywood for film, with 2 in active production. And his speaking tour has included hundreds of events all over the world, including throughout the U.S., such as the Library of Congress, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, throughout Europe, and in Israel. He's also the editor of the Cutting Edge News, which is a very prominent website which receives more than 1.5 million hits per month. Edwin has appeared on hundreds of television broadcasts from Oprah, The Today Show, CNN, NBC Dateline, and was just this morning on Fox News talking about the situation in Egypt. It's my pleasure to introduce my good friend Edwin Black.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for coming out on a very, very cold night. I think we're going to warm it up a little bit very shortly. I'd like to thank Shlomo for that wonderful introduction. I have a few thanks to give. One is to Shlomo Alfassa, who is extremely dedicated to the Sephardic community and to the Jewish community at large. You can all hear? Okay. I'd like to thank Lynn Winters and Stan Ehrman from this organization. Stan and I have been involved in collaboration for some time on several of my books. And I first came upon the Farhood in my book, Banking on Baghdad. I would also like to shout out to one of my chief research assistants, Eve, who lives in Brooklyn. She's right out there, and Eve was in constant communication in the archives and the libraries silently with other researchers around the world using Yahoo Messenger. We found something here in Germany, we found this in Washington, and she'd go and get it, and she's also a great fact checker. She was marshaled the team. So I have a lot of thanks. If I left anyone out, of course, my biggest thanks is to all of you who have come to this event. The way we're going to work it is I'm going to make my remarks. and tell you about the bad news of the Farhood. I would like to get one copy of the book. Can someone just bring me a physical copy? Then I'll take questions. We won't take any statements or speeches because I was the only one who was paid to speak. But in fairness to the audience, we'll take as many questions as you have. We'll try to answer all of your questions. Then, if you wish, for a few minutes, I'll be outside signing some books that the organization is selling, and then I'll try to get home and grab some sleep. Originally, I thought I was going to just, take a noon. Thank you. I was going to take a noon train. I was going to show up at night here. It'd be a meal. It'd be fine. Then I got after I did the piece on Egypt in the Arab Street and the Farhood as an example for FoxNews.com, they said, "Well, can you come be with us at 11 o'clock at 11 o'clock?" I said, "Yeah, that's fine. I'll finish up here and I'll take a taxi down there." Then about midnight last night, turns out that, by the way, you do know it's 11 o'clock in the morning. So I was up at 4, taking the train, and I just did my last radio interview just before I got here in my sleep. All right, so now we're going to wake everybody up. Of course, most of you know that when I come to deliver a presentation, it's always bad news. I'm either documenting IBM's undeniable involvement in organizing the Holocaust, General Motors in surreptitiously supplying the trucks and the torpedo heads and the bombers for the Third Reich, Ford for his involvement with Adolf Hitler, the Carnegie Institution and Rockefeller for funding the program that sent Mengele into Auschwitz. Those are the kinds of things that I do. But this is going to be the most nightmarish of my books, okay? My own research assistants could not sleep while doing the research. Now I'm going to do something I don't normally do. I'm going to read a little bit from my book. I'm going to read from the introduction. "This book is a nightmare. I regret anyone must read it. I regret it was necessary to write. I regret that I was the one who had to write it. I hope it never becomes necessary to write another one like this." There's a place in here, in one chapter, where I actually apologize to the readers in advance for the history I'm going to give. Okay. What is the Farhood? Those of you who are Sephardic, of course, know what the Farhood is in Arabic or in Kurdish, in a dialect. It means violent dispossession. This word for the larger Holocaust community fell off the radar in large part because it was a Sephardi tragedy, and also the Holocaust Museum, as many people in this room know, worked very hard to keep the word Farhood out of the lexicon and keep the Mufti out of their displays. In fact, Shlomo was involved in a program to commemorate the Farhood, which the Holocaust Museum sent a national blanket instruction or request to other Holocaust institutions to not participate. And a half decade later, they still blocked my research into this field. So that's what the Farhood is. But this book is actually not about the Farhood. It's 16 or 17 chapters. Martin Gilbert did the introduction, the foreword. Sam Edelman did the afterword. And it's actually the Farhood is the middle point. And it's become iconic. You could say it's almost like the Kristallnacht of the Jewish community in the Arab world. For me, the Farhud, which is the Nazi Arab pogrom of June 1st, June 2nd in Baghdad and other parts of Iraq, originally designed to exterminate completely the Jews of Iraq, but which failed and turned into a vicious pogrom and murder spree. This is a significant effort, a significant milestone in the history of the Holocaust and the history of World War II. When I say Nazi Arabs, I don't mean fascist Arabs. I don't mean right-wing Arabs. I mean swastika armband, march in Nuremberg with a torchlight, Mein Kampf reading, Hitler-loving Arabs. In other words, genuine Nazis. So I had to ask myself, how is it possible, since I know the history of the Jewish community in Iraq, I wrote a book about it, how is it possible that a Jewish community which had dwelled in peace in Iraq, Mesopotamia, for 2,600 years, that's 1,000 years before Islam, how is it that they became reviled and cast out of their homes, turned into Untermenschen, and ultimately expelled from their own nation? How'd that happen? And how is it that the Nazis, who were anti-Semitic, struck up a great partnership with the Arabs, who were Semites, and who the Germans acknowledged were Semites, and who were reviled for their eugenic, for their dysgenic nature? Semites, of course, meaning they are the descendants of Noah's son. Noah had three sons. One of them was Shem, and the descendants of Shem were Shemites, or as we know it here in America, Semites. So instead of just writing about this pogrom, as I did in my book, Banking on Baghdad, in a couple of paragraphs, I really want to go all the way back to the beginning of recorded time to identify who were the people dwelling in Mesopotamia, going back some 7,000 years. Who were the Jews? Who were the Nazis? How did all this come together? Ultimately, you'll find that the great binder of Jew hatred and Muslim-Nazi cooperation, Palestine, Iraq, Berlin, Europe, the great binder for all of this was oil. Something else I know about. In many ways, this story begins with the Medina extermination. Most of you know there's a Mecca and a Medina. Most people, and I realize we have an audience with a greater aptitude on some of these questions in this room, but most people do not know that Medina was originally a substantially Jewish city. Medina, Medinat, it comes from the Hebrew. Of course, in those days, Arabic was a proto-Arabic, and classic Arabic were still evolving, and the main language of the day was a kind of a Hebrew and a combination of Syriac and other dialects. Muhammad, in 627, came to Medina and asked, and at that time was praying to Jerusalem, not to Mecca, asked the Jews if they would convert to Islam, since they were very entrenched. And of course they said no. And so Muhammad had all 600 to 700 of the Jews of Medina beheaded in a protracted public ceremony, one by one by one, in a huge public ceremony. And then the Islamic forces ultimately subsumed the Arabian Peninsula. The Islamic conquest extended into all of the Middle East, North Africa, and made the Muslim world that became famous. This extermination of the Jews became iconic in the Muslim mind. Now, if you're a Christian, you might say the Sermon on the Mount is an iconic moment. If you are Jewish, you might say the parting of the Red Sea is an iconic moment. It's with you at all times. For the Muslims, this is one of their iconic moments. And it's not because I say so. It's because they said so. And they continued saying so every day, at every opportunity in which Jews came up. They said it to themselves, they said it in the market, they said it in their newspapers, on their radio stations, they said it to the British, and they said it to Adolf Hitler, eyeball to eyeball in his office. Roughly around 700, as the Islamic conquest has taken hold, not everyone has been forced to convert, and the Jews and Christians are allowed to continue as second and third class citizens called dhimmis. Most of you know this term, but for those who do not, it's D-H-I-M-M-I. And as dhimmis, they were second and third class citizens. They did not have religious freedom. They had to pay a special tax. In many instances, they were reviled. There are many Quranic injunctions and injunctions in the Hadith to murder the Jew in order to go into heaven, and that judgment day, even the trees and the rocks will say, kill the Jew behind me. There are plenty of those. In some cases, the Jews had to wear a yellow star. They had to ride a hard saddle. All sorts of ways that the Jews were legislated to be inferior to Muslims. Now, the first thing you're going to think is that perhaps this was the general rule. This was not the general rule. There was no general rule. Whether or not a Jew as a dhimmi thrived in his environment as an outstanding personality or was persecuted as an underdog varied from generation to generation, from country to country, from regime to regime, from decade to decade. But whether or not a Jew succeeded magnificently as a great merchant in Baghdad or was decimated in parts of Iran or North Africa, it was always as a dhimmi. Now, let's shoot forward, please, to nationalism, the end of the 19th century. Of course, the Ottoman Turks had been running Palestine. They'd been running it for hundreds of years as a sort of Islamic backwater. Was not a great holy place. It was not an illustrious one. It was good mainly for taxes. And the Ottomans, of course, were in Turkey. And at the end of the 19th century, all sorts of people rose up to identify themselves as an ethnic group or a national group, ready for self-determination. Maybe they all spoke a common language. Maybe they had the same religion. Maybe they had an ethnic national border. Maybe they were just between the two rivers. Maybe they had a common culture. Whatever it was that caused them to believe that they were a people, they began to have national aspirations, and they wanted to cast off the yoke of their ecclesiastic, dynastic, and monarchical regimes that governed them, just like you see today in the Middle East. And there's a good reason for that. And the Armenians did it, the Bulgarians did it, all sorts of ethnic groups became self-determining groups seeking to come home to create a nation of their own, worldwide. In the Jewish case, in about 1898, this manifested best as Jewish nationalism known as Zionism. And the Jews wanted to come home. And in about 10 years later, the Arabs followed suit. 1908, the Young Turk movement, mainly Christians, many of them from Lebanon, influenced by France, and they also wanted to identify their own Arab nation. Come World War I, there were efforts to hand out national and self-determination status by the Allies, by the British, by the French, by others, in exchange for cooperation to beat Turkey and Germany. Among these groups were the Jews, who had done many things to earn something called the Balfour Declaration, which means that Britain supports a Jewish homeland. Now, I'm sure all of you have heard of the Balfour Declaration, but many of you do not know that there was an nearly identical declaration in France, in the United States, under Woodrow Wilson. There was one even in Germany, and even the Sultan issued his own Balfour-style declaration during the war to go along with this movement, and finally it became ingrained in international law through the League of Nations. That meant that about 1921, Jews started to come back into Palestine. And this was unacceptable to the Arabs who lived there. It was one thing to live with their neighbors who were tolerated as dhimmis, but it was another thing for these other Jews, especially Jews from Europe who were escaping the murderous regime of the Tsar, of the Russians, and of East European pogroms, to live side by side with Jews who thought that they were independent, who had a home of their own, who were not dhimmis. And this is where we get to say that there never was a day of peace in Palestine, not an hour, not a day, between Jews and Arabs going back almost 150 years. If anyone in this room knows of a day that there was peace, stand and tell me what day it was. There was no such day and no such hour. And how did it manifest? In the case of the Arabs, it manifested in profound violence. The Arabs would attack the Jews in mobs. They would attack them in the shadows. One by one, they would burn their Torahs, they would invade their synagogues, and they had their own slogans. And one of their slogans was, Falastin Bladna, Falastin Bladna. And that means Palestine is our land. But that's actually only half the rhyme. Here's the rest of the rhyme. Palestine Bladna, al-Yahud Klabna. Palestine is our land, and the Jew is our dog. That was not 1967. That was not 1948. That was 1920 and 1921. And that was not once, and that was not twice. That was the chant. And Jews were murdered on a regular basis. Come about, and by the way, when you say Palestine, nobody knew where the heck it was. What was Palestine? It was Israel until the Romans threw the Jews out and renamed it Syria Palestina. And many thought it was kind of attached to Syria and as a southern part of Syria. They weren't sure how far it extended toward Jordan, to Transjordan, real Jordan, to the river, beyond the river, to Gaza, beyond Gaza. So no one really knew. And all of the maps and reports of the day said, we don't really know, but here's our guess of how big Palestine is. Around 1928, as more and more Jews are coming in, and by the way, in those early years, we're only talking about a trickle of Jews, like 1%, 2%, 3%. And with them, they brought modernity. They were different. They didn't blend in. They lived in square houses. They were merchants of a different type. They had their own technology. Around 1928, the Jews went to the Wailing Wall, the last remnant of Solomon's temple on Yom Kippur, and decided to sit down when they prayed because it's hot in Israel. And the Muslims said, don't do that. Now, because Jews were dhimmis, because they were second-class citizens, Jews were not actually permitted to sit while they prayed at the Western Wall. Now, the British had the unfortunate dichotomy obligation of both promoting a Jewish homeland and enforcing the status quo. The status quo was before World War I. It was established by many, many fatwas and decisions of Sharia law, which could be quoted chapter and verse. Jews may not sit down. Why? If a Jew had the ability to sit down at will without permission at the Wailing Wall, it would connote that maybe they had a right. And the Wailing Wall, maintained the Muslims, was actually their holy place. Why? It was called Al-Barak. Why was it their holy place? Because Muhammad, on his way to heaven, riding atop a white-winged horse, tethered his horse, went to the furthest mosque, Al-Aqsa, went to the furthest mosque, tethered his horse to that wall, and then went to heaven. So because Muhammad's horse with wings was tethered to that wall, it became holy, and Jews could not sit down while they prayed at that wall. And the British had to enforce this. And when the Jews decided to sit down, the British actually started to pull the chairs out from people. Don't sit, don't sit. This is what the British police were doing. Ultimately, the Jews did sit, and the Muslims warned, don't do that again. They did do it again. 1929, Tisha B'Av, Jewish holiday. The Jews went to the wall. There are more Jews in Palestine now. They said, the wall is ours. And we have the right to sit. We also have the right to make a mechitza to separate the men from the women. And we're going to be sitting down. Well, the wall at that time was controlled by a guy called Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, Not only was he the Mufti of Jerusalem, he was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Who made Husseini the Mufti of Jerusalem? The British. In fact, they made him not only the Mufti, but the Grand Mufti, so he'd even be a bigger Mufti, so that he could have control over the local populace, and they allowed him to have a kind of a shadow government. He had control over religious institutions. There were certain land trusts. There were properties. As you know, they just demolished the Shepherd Hotel. That was one of his operations. He had political organizations. He was on the payroll of the British taxpayer. And the Mufti of Jerusalem started to bring animals in. I believe it was sheep, maybe cattle. They would drop their dung right there at the wall. They would ring gongs, do everything they could to make it uncomfortable for the Jews to have a holy moment sitting down at the wailing wall. Nonetheless, on Tisha B'Av, the Jews did sit down, and as a result of that, the Arabs in 1929 rioted. They stabbed, they shot, they beat skulls in. The post-mortuarial autopsy said they'd never seen so many skulls post-mortuarially crushed in. They tore the settles out of the wailing wall, the supplications people give to God. They burned Torahs, holy books, and that was the front line of their riot. And the British deployed all of their police forces there. While the British are deploying all of their police forces there, the main group runs up to Hebron in 1929 and commits a murderous rampage of destruction and killing. Scores of defenseless Jews in Hebron are massacred because Jews sat down. Why? How were they massacred? They weren't just killed. Each one was killed according to his character. The baker, he was baked in his own oven. The scholar, his head was cut open, his brain was extricated, and they played ball with his brain. One woman was crucified against a wall, a door. Babies were sliced. People were stabbed. Torahs burned. There's an abundant amount of photographic evidence about this. Ultimately, the British declared martial law. They called in airplanes with machine guns. They machine gunned the rioters in the street. And all this because the Jews sat down when they prayed. Not because they declared a state, just because they sat. Okay, come 1933, in comes Adolf Hitler, and the Arabs say, this is our guy. What we want, he wants. He believes the Jews are Untermenschen. We believe the Jews are Untermenschen. He wants them to wear funny clothing. We have made them wear funny clothing. We have had restrictions. He has restrictions. So they all chase after the Third Reich, and they say, we want to become Arab Nazis. And Berlin says back to them, we don't want you. You can't be a Nazi. In order to be a Nazi, form a Nazi party, you have to be an Aryan, and you're a Semite. They say, well, if you won't make us official Nazis, we'll form our own Nazi parties. Even today, you can go on the internet and look at the Syrian National Socialist Party. Their website, their flag, is still a modified swastika. Okay. Now, why does Hitler not want to have common cause with the Arabs? Well, the Semites, and actually, the Germans are committed to Palestine. They want to push the Jews out of Germany, out of Europe, and into Palestine. And of course, as you know, there was a transfer agreement between the Zionists in which the unwanted Jews were allowed to take a pittance of their property into Palestine. And so many Jews fled. And where did they go? They fled right into Palestine. And so the very Germany that the Arabs idealized was the source of so much of their problem. More and more Jews came to coexist. And when they came, they brought their Mozart, they brought their Linzer Torts, they brought their Beethoven, and they brought their European culture, further transforming this land of Palestine. We're moving now. I don't want you to think that Germany was committed to a Jewish state. They thought that if they congregated the Jews in Palestine, they could finish them off in one fell swoop at the right time. So that was the plan, one which almost came to pass. So we're moving now toward about 1937, and the Peel Commission, through riots and riots and murders and irreconcilable differences, one commission after another says, these two people can never have a binational state. We will have to separate this land into a Jewish state and a national state, a Jewish state and an Arab state, and they will live in peace with each other. The Jews said, okay, and the Arabs said, never. The Arabs said to the British, remember this part for the national determination, better you should keep us as a British colony for 100 years than we should live next door to Jews who have the right to run their own country. I'm going to read you something. Now, when I say Arabs and Muslims, I'm not talking about a band of Arabs in the marketplace in Jerusalem. I'm talking about not a mufti, but a movement. And I'm not talking about a movement, but a mass movement. Global. Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, London, Yugoslavia, India, they all found common cause under the leadership of the Mufti of Jerusalem, who once again told them, you need to support our cause, because if you don't, Jews will sit when they pray at the Wailing Wall, and that's the first step. Now I'm going to read something to you. Our hatred for the Jews dates from God's condemnation of them for their persecution and rejection of Jesus and their subsequent rejection later of his chosen prophet Muhammad. Verily, the word of God teaches us, and we implicitly believe this, for a Muslim to kill a Jew ensures him an immediate entry into heaven and into the august presence of God Almighty. What more, then, can a Muslim want in this hard world? That's a quote. Who made this quote in 1937? Was it some shopkeeper to his buddy in the marketplace? This was the King of Saudi Arabia in an official lecture to the British Foreign Ministry, which became an official document. And he was not alone. This is what they said. This is what they believed. And this is a continuity. Right about that time, Hitler and the Third Reich say, wait a minute. We've been pushing the Jews into Palestine. What have we done here? Peel Commission, Peel Report says maybe they're going to make a Jewish state. It'll become a Jewish Vatican. They'll gather all their muscle there and they'll wage war against us because, of course, they believed in Henry Ford's theory of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, that there was an international worldwide Jewish conspiracy. All of a sudden now, around 1937, as the King of Saudi warned the British, if you let the Jews self-determine their future, we will go to the Germans. And that's what happened. Because right about that time, the Germans realized that war was absolutely going to be coming. And with war, they needed the one thing that the Arabs had, oil. Who owned the oil? The British owned the oil. Anglo-Persian Oil Company in Iraq, Anglo-Iranian Oil Company in Iran. What is the name of that company today? British Petroleum. So Britain, oil, British Petroleum, pipeline from Iraq to Haifa, which was built, all bundled up together into this dynamic. Huge riots in 1937, Arab revolt in Jerusalem. It's true, the Arabs were not monolithic in Palestine. They absolutely, there were many people who said, we'd love to get along with the Jews. They're buying our property. They're good for business. I'll give you an example. The Nashashibi family, just as prominent as the Husseini family, preferred to live in peace with the Jews. But these forces, these movements of conciliation, neighborliness, coexistence, peace, togetherness, were always battered down by the forces of hatred, by the forces of intimidation. They were shouted down, they were murdered down, they were ruled out, they were ostracized, and ultimately the hate and the Husseinis won out. 1937, there's a huge revolt. Arsons, bombings, murders, rampant violence. An Arab could even be murdered by his own people just for taking a Jew in a taxi across town. British put a stop to it, especially after one of their high officials, their vice governors, is assassinated. Husseini escapes just as he's about to be arrested. Where does he escape to? He escapes to Baghdad. 1941, the Germans are getting ready for Operation Barbarossa. They want to go into Russia. They need what Iran and Iraq have, oil. Time to cut a deal. The plan and the directive is established with Hitler directly. The Mufti of Jerusalem is part of a coup called the Golden Square. 1941, spring, they take over the government of Iraq. They declare they're no longer at war with Nazi Germany. It's time to give Germany the oil. The British tried to rescue the oil of Anglo-Persian Oil Company. June 1st. There's a plan by this overwhelming group of Hitler Youth and Nazi organizations in Iraq to completely exterminate the Jews. What did they do? All Jews, sit in your house, lock the door, pack a bag and food for 3 days railroad journey. All the houses marked by the Hamsa in red ink. When it came time for the announcement at noon for all the Jews to be rounded up and committed to an extermination plan, the titular mayor, the temporary mayor of Baghdad, intervened for the chief rabbi, ousted the ringleaders. The Jews were not exterminated. The citizenry, mobs, citizen groups, groups in the military, groups in the police, banded together and unleashed a wild pogrom against the Jews. Raced through the streets. They knew where the Jews lived because, of course, the way they dressed, their names, and because they had the Hamsa. Raced through the streets, cut them down where they were. Babies were cut in half, thrown into the river. Girls were raped in front of their parents. Parents were murdered in front of their children. They battered down the homes, family after family, raced to the roof, from one rooftop to another. They jumped, they fled. Some kids and family members were cut down on the way to the roof. Others threw their babies down to a blanket waiting below. And after 2 days, June 1st, June 2nd, the riot was finally put down by the British and other forces, and British-appointed forces. Mufti of Jerusalem fled, went into Iran, which in 1935 changed its name from Persia in honor of its ancient name, Aryan, which was confused with the Nazi word of Aryan and became Iran, the name we know today. It was infused with 2,000 members of agents of the Third Reich. Churchill and the Allies said, you've got 24 hours to get rid of your Nazis. They said, well, give us till Tuesday. They said, 24 hours? We need a couple of days. Churchill invaded the next day. Nazi Shah was thrown out. Nazi-leaning Shah was thrown out. His son was brought in, the Shah of Iran, whose name you know, and who was evicted before Khomeini. Mufti of Jerusalem escapes from Iran, goes directly to Berlin, no more urban riots. Now we're going to cut a deal with Hitler, face to face. And that deal is, we will give you the oil you need to do what you need in Eastern Europe. You will kill the Jews, and when you are at the key point, you will recognize an Arab nation. You will kill the Jews not only in Palestine, you will kill them in Europe. Any Jew anywhere is a threat to us. Hitler said, I will do it, not today. I'll do it when we cross the Caucasus Mountains. Arabs, Mufti of Jerusalem, etc., said, we'll do everything we can to help you cross the Caucasus Mountains. And so the Arabs formed assembled tens of thousands of Muslims and Arabs into battle units. Three Waffen SS divisions, Hanschar, Kama, Skanderbeg, not a militia, divisions, not 10 guys, not 10,000 guys, but tens of thousands, artillery, infantry, paratroopers. From Paris, I was speaking to a woman in Florida the other day, actually, it was at the Park East, in front of the European survivors, Nachas, and a woman said, we saw them with the fezes in the Warsaw Ghetto. They had intelligence units in Paris, and they operated mainly in Yugoslavia with these three divisions. And not only that, they formed, as part of this movement, the most heinous, blood-curdling murder regime in the history of the Third Reich and the Holocaust. A magnitude more horrifying than Auschwitz. They partnered with the Catholics of Croatia under the aegis of Heinrich Himmler and the Mufti of Jerusalem to create the Ustashi. The Ustashi were the most murderous of all the killers. Babies, Jewish babies, would be thrown into open fires. They would wave them around, and bayonets would take them down. They didn't just kill Jews, they killed Serbs, they killed other Muslims. Everyone killed everyone. But the people who ran the Ustashi was this binational killer regime, Muslim and Catholic, under the aegis of the Mufti of Jerusalem. In one night at a concentration camp called Jasenovac, there was a contest to see who could cut the most throats right then and there that night. One guy cut 650 throats. Another guy next to him cut 1,100 throats, and the winner cut 1,350 throats in one night. with a special little knife attached to their, and we have the names. Always as sport. Always as sport. The Germans are using euphemisms, Sonderbehandlung, you know, special handling. Not with the Muslims. Kill, exterminate, kill. Kill wherever you see them. On the radio. And then when there were opportunities for children to be transported from Eastern Europe in bribes and bargains into Palestine, the Mufti of Jerusalem would send passionate letter after letter to the foreign minister of Bulgaria and Hungary, don't send these little children under the Red Cross to Palestine, send them to Poland. 1942, 43, 44. By that time, everybody knew, of course, that from 42, that Poland was a killing center with gas. In fact, there was a little girl in Amsterdam from 1942 hiding in an attic, and she even heard it on the BBC. Ultimately, Hitler fell. And the Muslim desire to kill all the Jews fell with it. The Holocaust ended in Europe in 1945, but then continued in its own way in the Muslim world. We're using the Eichmann method, and with the help of a platoon of Gestapo agents, SS guards, camp guards, created their own anti-Jewish infrastructure, created the modern Middle East that dominated the latter part of the 20th century, which became inherited by the 21st century. Using the Eichmann method, the Jews were identified, all their money was taken, and they were expelled into Israel as a sort of a demographic bomb. And when I say they expelled them, I mean they, penniless, they actually pulled the rings out of their ears and searched in case anyone would hide some gems in their body. Horrible experience. The Jews did not allow their landsmen from Arab lands to die on the beach in tents. They were absorbed. They were made part of the country. In many ways, people believe, I'm sure you'll say, that the Sephardic control many parts of Israeli society today, a generation or two later. And during that time, they actually still never gave up their love of Hitler. More kids in World War II, almost more, were called Hitler than Muhammad. They even had a little legend about Hitler, the Führer. His real name wasn't Adolf Hitler. His real name was Muhammad Hadar, a little Egyptian boy from a small village who went to all the mosques. In fact, I have a little letter to a newspaper I'd like to read you. By the way, you could find this today. Go on the internet. Google the name of a guy called Hitler Tanawi. Who is Hitler Tanawi? He's just an ordinary civil servant. But his name is Hitler. Let's see if I can find you a nice one here. Here's a letter written in the 50s, maybe the 60s. It's a letter to Hitler for the Cairo Weekly Al-Muswar. It says, "My dear Hitler," this is by an army guy in the Egyptian army. He says, "I congratulate you from the bottom of my heart. Even if you appear to have been defeated, in reality, you are the victor. And he goes on to say, "The only mistake you made was you trusted too many people, and we would love to have, if you appear again in Germany, or if a new Hitler arises, in your wake, it'll be great." The letter was signed with affection. Sadat wrote that letter. and wore swastikas. On his tie for his historic trip to Israel. Check the pictures. You'll find them. Okay. So what's the message here? You're going to say it's hopeless. It seems hopeless. Because this legacy of hate extends back 1,400 years, applies itself at every opportunity. Even recently, Mahmoud Abbas said, we will never recognize a Jewish state. You can call yourself Israel, you can call yourself anything you like, but never a Jewish state. 22 Islamic members of the Arab League. No Jewish state. But the reality is, it is possible for peace to be achieved. Even after I wrote this. There is a peace treaty, at least for the next few days, with Egypt. There is one with Jordan. Is it a real peace? No. Is it better than a good, is it a bad peace? Yeah. Is it better than a good war? Right. Coexistence can occur. With coexistence, a generation of coexistence can yield to a generation of peace. And a generation of peace can produce a generation of true brotherhood. So, I believe that the takeaway message is if we confront honestly, this legacy of hate, and do so correctly, we can achieve a future of peace. Thank you. And now I'm going to take some questions, all of which are historical. I want nothing in anything I said to be a pretext for use against our neighbors. I'm talking about the Holocaust, the 20th century. You've got a couple of people on either side, just one, who's got a microphone, and we will take a question. I'll answer you as honestly as I can. This is Shlomo Alfasa. Start with this woman. Do you have the mic here? Let's start with this woman here.
I'm going to hold it. Hi. I just want to say that I was doing a little research on the Mufti of Jerusalem, and because I got some emails about him. And when I went to research, every book that I took out had the picture of the Mufti in Hitler ripped out.
Ripped out. The Mufti in Hitler, which you've seen it many times, it's an iconic picture. This is the picture of the Mufti in Yugoslavia with the Waffen-SS and other Hanchar groups reviewing the troops, and this iconic picture. These were not secret pictures. This was not a bunker meeting. This had newsreels. It had film. It had newspapers. It was done with pride. The Mufti was on earned twice as much as a general. He was on the Nazi payroll. He had villas. He had an Islamic institute. They had a battalion of imams sent out from Berlin to cater to the troops. There were instructions from Himmler himself that I have seen saying no one will crack a Muslim joke, and all dietary traditions will be observed. So there has been an effort, and there's been an effort in some academic quarters, very few, one, to get me to drop it, and I won't. And I speak about this at universities, synagogues, Catholic institutions. It doesn't matter. And we need to face the fact that the Mufti of Jerusalem, who during this recent news coverage was called His Eminence, was in fact the Hitler of the Arab people. I hope that answers your question. The next question, please. And then we'll move around to this side, too, so we'll go back and forth.
At first, I read about the Farhud in the Jewish Herald.
In which?
In the Jewish Herald.
The Jewish Herald, the one that I wrote.
Right, yes. And okay. I was wondering, I knew some of it. Why don't we see any, this written in the mainstream American papers to that extent?
Lama, what?
Why is the Farhud in mainstream American papers?
I'll give you a partial answer to an overfull question. Yeah, the question was, Slucha, how come he read my article in one of the Jewish papers about the Farhud? Why is this not covered more generally? There's been a narrative, in large part established with the best of intentions, that the Shoah, that the Holocaust, was a European experience. My parents, other people's parents in Poland, Hungary, and they failed to understand many things about the Holocaust. That Hitler had helpers, not only from America with IBM, but from other ethnic groups. And they think that this war against the Jews had a bright line, and it never crossed that line. There's also a huge ignorance about the history of the Sephardic Jewish community, which is why the work of this institution, this federation of Shlomo, of Stan Erman, and Malcolm Honlein, and many others whose names I have not mentioned, is so important because they're really giving half or maybe 49% of the full story. Raoul Hilberg wrote a triumphant book, The History, The Destruction of European Jewry, and the Holocaust Museum has had a narrative that the Holocaust occurred mainly in Europe, and there's no Henry Ford, and there's no General Motors, there's no IBM, and mainly that if the Holocaust Museum did not invent it, it don't exist. So a lot of things collaborate. You know, when you think of a Jewish guy, you often think of a European name. So in point of fact, these are the many factors that have caused people to not bring this up. But there's another factor, the harsh reality of what it means. No one will stop to say that the Germans killed the Jews. No one will deny that the Romanians killed the Jews. But it is possible for some to find it difficult to admit that there was a pan-Islamic and pan-Arabic desire to exterminate the Jews. And so what I did was I didn't go to the case, to the evidence. I went there last, and I started with the roots, and I took it 1,400 years to explain why. I hope that answers your question a little bit. Take someone from this side. You grabbed the mic? Don't let it go.
Yes.
Don't give the guy the mic.
No, quick. No, I don't need that. I have a loud enough voice.
All right.
My question is this.
What's your name?
My name is George Silverman.
How'd it go?
Your talk?
Yeah. Okay, what's your question?
The Museum of the Holocaust.
Slicha. Who has the phone?
Why does the Holocaust Museum try to block your findings because less sincere people have written the same stuff? Rabbi Dahlin, for example.
Rabbi Dahlin and John Rothman.
But he's
on the radio show in a few days in San Francisco.
No, he's an apologist for Pius XII. Why are they against you? Why is the museum and the establishment against you? And what is the example of the Turkish Balfour Declaration? You mentioned that there was some type of a little, just like the Germans, that the Turks...
Okay. While I'm doing this, could you go to the index and find the Turkish? It's about 1917-ish. Talat Pasha. Anyway, the question is, why does the Holocaust Museum stop me from bringing this out? Before I answer that, I'm going to ask you, how come they stopped you before when you tried to ask the question? You take the mic.
I did a project in 2004 across the whole country on the Farhud, and this is where I met Edwin. And Edwin learned about the Farhud a lot at the same time I was doing that. And the Holocaust Museum did not give me any access to their materials. Matter of fact, our chief historian, a gentleman with two PhDs, told me himself in front of a witness, a prominent rabbi in Brooklyn who was with me, that the Arabs and the Nazis only had a couple of superficial meetings in North Africa, and he literally giggled at me.
Why?
Okay. You want the good answer, or you want the real truth? Money talks. Corporate money, IBM, Ford, GM. Most of you remember that there was a picture of the IBM machine with a big IBM logo. Okay? Somehow, after I came up with my book, they pixelated over the logo so you couldn't see it. He said, well, it was an accident. You can't have an accent of pixelation on one little tiny piece of a picture. What did they do? Go to the Holocaust Museum where that machine was. You'll see two holes in the marble. It was taken out and replaced with a smaller machine with an aged IBM decal on the back. I said, why did you remove this machine? They said, too many people were looking at it. It was a difficulty for the museum. You'll see it on the floor yourself. That museum is now in a warehouse hiding. I don't ask for permission. Whatever I do, I fight for history, whether it hurts or not. I wrote the transfer agreement about the Zionists and the Nazis. I wrote this book. I wrote IBM. I did Nazi Nexus. I did War Against the Weak about Carnegie and Rockefeller with eugenics. I did all this stuff. I did it without permission. They didn't know. They refused to know. They were left out. They have a lot of different reasons. But the main reason is arrogance. Arrogance. It's just arrogance. If they can't control him, and if they can't control some other people, and if then it doesn't go their way. Even on this book, you found the spot? Yeah. They didn't want me to sit down. Guess what? I'll sit without permission anytime. So, even on this book, Ustashi is very difficult. All the documentation, which they are the only ones who have it in this country, are in Serbian. There's only one guy who's got it. It's extremely confusing. The average expert could look at it. He could be very confused. One guy's killing one guy the next minute, then the next guy's killing him the next minute. It's very hard to understand, I assure you. I tried to talk to their chief expert on the Ustashi, who knew the documents well. They canceled my interview with him. They wouldn't let me even talk to the man. So anyway, oh, and here's another thing. The survivors, there's a survivor group called Nahos, N-A-H-O-S. They've been trying to get their records from Bad Arelson. And I was the one who was on this case. And they claimed that these 80, 90-year-old people had to fly in from Brooklyn and Miami to look at the computer files in Washington, only they would have them. They claimed that these were computer files that for some reason could not be copied. There's a computer file that cannot be copied. Meanwhile, it's in 13 countries around the world and only in one place in the United States. this stops them from fundraising. I don't want to go any further. I think we've exhausted the conversation. Basically, it's their way or the highway. And in my case, it's the information highway. Now, you want to, who asked me about the Turkish? Well, I believe it came in about 1918, and first Germany, they were about to lose the war, and it was after Wilson, and Germany was suing for peace. The Turks were suing for peace from the British. The British had invaded Iraq for the sole purpose of getting the oil, and among the things they said, well, let's go along with this Zionist declaration to show we're in with the international community, and maybe things will go better for us. So it's one of the things they did. But remember this, for years, Herzl tried to make a Jewish colony legally with the permission of the Ottoman Sultan. He offered millions and millions of dollars to bring the Ottomans out of debt. And the Sultan took bribes, left bakshish, left, right, top, and center. But there was no bribe sufficient to make the Sultan allow the Jew to have his own colony on his own soil. So I hope that answers the question. Let's take another question here. Here's a young lady. All right, let's take this young gentleman.
Thank you. I have a question that's not specifically in the Farhud, but
okay.
Maybe it is historical and it deals with that period. Maybe you might be able to shed some light on it. If the British hadn't stopped the Nazis at Alamein, my understanding is that they would have moved up to Palestine and Israel and then would have attempted their eradication program against all the Jews living there at that time. And I've sometimes asked people that I've heard speak about this period what the plans were of the Jews living at that time in the 40s in Israel, people like Ben-Gurion, the Palmach, how are they going to defend themselves against the slaughter? And I've never really gotten any specific information about that. I was told there were plans.
Okay.
Do you have any knowledge about that?
Yeah, I do.
Thank you.
Here you go. The question was, if the British had not stopped the Nazis in North Africa, I told you that the plan was to get into Palestine and kill all the Jews. What would have happened? What was the Jewish plan? Well, the Jews were not in control that much of Palestine. That was still the British were controlling it. And the Arabs were always appealing to the Luftwaffe, please drop bombs on Jerusalem. And the Luftwaffe would say, are you aware that if we drop bombs on Jerusalem, we'll kill a bunch of Arabs? He says, yes, just drop bombs on Jerusalem. And ultimately, the plans of so-called extermination in Palestine, whether with mobile gas vans, because the guy with the mobile gas vans was already brought into Morocco and to Tunisia. There were always theories that he was going to set up a gas chamber. There were many concentration camps in North Africa run by Muslims. Now remember, many Muslims in North Africa saved their neighbors. You heard me? Just like Polish and French saved their neighbors. But the worst, most heinous concentration camps were run by Muslims in North Africa. One of their tactics was to bury people up to their neck and to urinate on their heads. And if they moved, they would beat them wildly. So there was no definitive plan, but there were plans. And I even have a picture here in the book. Right there. Of the Nazi Palestine flag, ready to go into business. But it never happened, and the idea was that they would either set up concentration camps. You know, it's easy to have a plan when you're on the offensive. When you're on the defensive, plans change. So there was no definitive plan, but there were plans. And those plans were constantly altered because, as you remember, once the forward motion of the Nazis was stopped on the east by the Russians, they were in a contraction mode. Once Normandy occurred, they were in a contraction mode. That's the best and most, and that's why I did not make more of it. I know that others do that, but woulda, coulda, shoulda is not part of what I do. You had a question.
We have one right here first.
Okay, yes, please. What's your name?
Helen Friedman.
Hi, how are you, Helen?
Hi. You gave us a fascinating overview. I want to thank you so much. But from the very beginning, we're talking about the year 700, what was it that was so attractive about Muhammad's message that it was able to take over the world and become so powerful? Just like I don't understand how today, despite everything we know about Islam and all its atrocities, it still keeps winning people over.
Well, let's speak about back then. Now, it's kind of complex to explain why Muhammad had his special appeal. And if I give you one very good explanation, there would be 1,000 more very good explanations. But one of them that scholars have is that Muhammad wanted to have his God in his language for his people, almost politically. Remember, Islam is a political movement. There are three Abrahamic religions, main Abrahamic religions, there are more. One is the Jews, who are exclusionary. We want to keep to ourselves, we want to live till Shabbos, and we don't want anyone to join us. The Christians reformed that and said, they are inclusionary, we'd like to include everybody. And the Muslims believed that they were conquest, that where they were was their land, and he who dwelt in it must submit. The concept of dhimmitude is to submit. It's not just to be, it is to submit. One of the ideas was that Christianity at that time was associated with the Roman Empire. And Judaism was associated with the European world. And that this would be a religion that was strictly for the Arab Semites, with a new language that would be made, a new modern Arabic that would be made, and was part of that identity. That's one answer. I've heard it from some very good scholars, but it might put into context to you that this is not just a guy who comes out of a cave and says, I've seen this this revelation. There's a political thing. And of course, going to the Jews, they're in the power structure of Medina. So this is all part and parcel of what it was. As you know, the Islamic conquest believes, unlike the pre-Roman Christian expression, give unto Caesar what is Caesar's, the Islamic conquest was to build a religion, a national, a state religion, and to make the religion and the state dominion one. So that is part of the answer. Let me take another question. This woman here had a question. What's your name?
Carol Bassery.
Oh, Carol, of
course.
Hi, how are you?
Good to see. You did a great job. I have a question for you. What about the British and the Far'ud? Because my understanding is that they were sitting on the outskirts of town when June 1st and 2nd came, and that they could have come in earlier but didn't. And I know of a number of people like Naeem Dungour, for example, who you probably came across his name, who have tried to get the records for the last 40, 50 years from the British. It's now over that 50-year mark, and they still won't allow it under the Freedom of Information Act.
I have the records. You can call me.
Did you get it?
Sure. All right.
Okay, so
you can take this. All right. I didn't want to get too much into that story in this lecture. I did write another book called British Petroleum and the Red Line Agreement. And the British went in to rescue the Anglo-Persian, now known as British Petroleum, oil. Their idea was to keep hasholom, had to keep peace in the area, and to just reinstall their put-up regent to run the joint. And so what they said is, we're going to encamp 8 miles outside of town. We've already defeated the Arabs at Habaniya, which was a base. We've defeated the Germans who tried to bomb Habaniya and who tried to make common cause with the Arabs. And if we are seen interceding in this Jewish riot, they're going to think that we're running the municipal affairs. And so consequently, they did nothing. But it isn't that they were 8 miles away. They were actually sitting inside Baghdad in the embassy grounds, some of them. And here we have the writings of Decher, D-E-C-H-A-I-R. He's written one short book. He's an intelligence officer. I have all three versions of his book. We have many documents from the Habaniya records. And we know exactly what they were doing and why they were doing it. And their job was not to come to the assistance. They heard the screams and did nothing. It was only after 2 days, when after the riots came to a halt, that the region was convinced to bring out forces under the aegis of the British and restore peace. So yes, you are correct. Yes, I've got the records. And yes, I quote them. And yes, Eve Jones up there checked my facts to make sure everything was footnoted properly. I hope that answers your question, Carol. Five more questions. Take them from that side. Well, that's a good question. She wants to know how many Jews were killed. The official record shows about 200 killed, 200 or more killed. But actually, many, many more were killed. But many people were intimidated into not giving testimony. They were not allowed to be buried individually. They were buried in a mass grave. And so historians guesstimate, that up to about 600, maybe Carol will agree with this number, about 600 Jews were killed. Eve, how many were killed? 600 to 800 Jews were killed during that time. And there were Jews in other areas of Iraq who were being massacred at that time, but it was never as organized as it was. My friend Sam Edelman went up to the north, and there were people there who said that there was a Farhud here, and these people saved those Jews from that. So I hope that answers the question. Another question here? The man on the edge there with his hand up. Oh, I'm sorry. We've got one here in the back. Yes?
Yeah.
Only one mic, yes?
Yeah.
I can hardly see you.
Okay. It'd help if I stand.
Okay.
All right. Scott Smith, this quick question. I was wondering why everything with justifying the creation of Israel is mostly focused on what happened in Europe, whether from Dreyfus or the Shoah perpetrated by Germany. And there isn't so much in terms of what the Arabs have done over the century, the Muslim rule over the centuries, or what the Arabs did during
That's your question.
Yes.
What was his question?
Why is there less reference to what was done to the Jews under Muslim rule?
Because I just wrote the book.
Okay.
And there will probably be another 5 books now, and they can't keep it quiet any longer. And on top of that, I'm using the word Farhud not only as a pogrom, but as an adjective to express an entire embodiment of violence and hate. So when the Jerusalem Post ran my piece on the Hebron massacre of 1929, you might see it on my website, farhudbook.com, author articles, it says, "A Farhud legacy of hate. You, Shlomo, others have taken the word farhud and put it into the dictionary as a noun, as an adjective, as an adverb, as a movement, as a midpoint, as a midpoint, as a nexus between Palestine, Iraq, Yugoslavia, Berlin, oil. They can't hide from all that. And so you won't be able to ask me that question in 3 years. I hope that answers the question now. Okay, we'll take this guy.
Hello, my name is Mark Davis. In Yugoslavia, which groups collaborated with the Croatian Ustashi in Yugoslavia?
When you say which groups, do you mean which religious groups?
Any kind of groups.
Okay. He says, which groups cooperated with the Catholic Muslim Ustashi? To a large extent, they all fought with each other and against each other. That's the best way I could say it. If you know what the Balkan Wars looked like in subsequent iterations, you see how difficult it was to discriminate who was fighting who. But one of the main murder thrusts was for Muslims and Roman Catholics, and I mean Vatican Catholics, I mean priests in churches, to destroy, convert, or exterminate all Orthodox Serbians, all non-cooperating Muslims, and all Jews. And to do this, various groups cooperated with various groups. To counteract Hitler and Hitler's need to get oil across, the partisans of Yugoslavia allied with the Stalinists and the communists became active to sabotage bridges, depots, convoys, to bog the Nazis down. The Muslims did everything they could to accelerate this forward motion. In the process, they began to create their own state called Croatia, which was a Nazi outlaw regime that was based upon murder, and the murder was so heinous that their Nazi supervisors, top generals, it's in the book, top generals said, never in the history of humanity has there been such horrible violence as this. If the Nazis think it's too terrible for words, imagine how terrible it is. That's the best I can give you.
We're going to take three more questions.
Three
that's
more
all.
Questions.
And then you can talk with Edwin outside in the Great Hall.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm sorry that we can't get to everybody.
Thanks. Sir, about how many escaped German officers managed to be absorbed into the Arab League armies, and what kind of field positions or ranks did they occupy by May of 1948, if you know?
All right, that's a great question. About how many of these Nazi, key Nazi people escaped into the Arab countries? About roughly 2,000. Many adopted Arabic names, some converted to Islam, and generally they were not rank and file. They were the director of intelligence, they were director of military training, director of police intelligence, police squads. Many of them were information services, and many of them helped establish in 1948 that the war of independence on Israel would not be Palestine for the Palestinians, but, quote, a war of extermination. So it's about 2,000. We give some of the names in the book itself. How many more questions we got? Shlomo? Two more, this guy.
The traditional narrative is that Hitler hated the Jews and once he assumed power, he would implement the Holocaust. Yet in your book, The Transfer Agreement, Germany was allowing Jews to leave, and apparently Eichmann had a program to have Jews settle in Madagascar. And in your talk, you mentioned that the Mufti, as one of his conditions to Hitler, wanted a Holocaust implemented. So my question is, do you think the Holocaust was preordained policy, or was it part of a evolving policy that resulted in Wanson.
Okay, I get it. His question is one of predeterminism. Is it the reality that Hitler said, I'm in power now, January 30th, 1933. Tomorrow, I'm going to murder every Jew there is. I have to give it to you two ways. One, there was no determinism, period. They never knew, they never decided on a given day early on, we are going to murder all the Jews. The actual initial policy was expulsion and emigration. How did they emigrate? Well, it's an interesting story. There was a worldwide anti-Nazi boycott and led by Stephen Wise. I'm sure you know the name. American Jewish Congress. The committee was against it. The committee did not want to fight Hitler because of German relatives. B'nai B'rith did not want to fight Hitler. The committee and B'nai B'rith were not Zionists. This is a different decade. That's not today. I'm telling you what was, okay? And Hitler, no Jew would stand up to Hitler and say, we're part of an international world organization, because the last thing the committee or the B'nai B'rith or anybody wanted to do was say, oh, we're part of the international Jewish conspiracy. Except the Zionist Federation said, oh, we are. We're part of an international Jewish organization. We can stop the boycott. But what we want is we want the Jews saved. Why? Because the Jews were being systematically, mentally, financially, physically destroyed. Not in long death marches, but one by one. Now, where did this idea come from? Even when I wrote the book, The Transfer Agreement, I didn't know. When I wrote this book, The Farhud, I realized that this idea was invented not by the Zionists with Hitler, but by Herzl in 1903 after Kishinev with the Tsar. He went right to the Tsar after Kishinev and said, you don't want these Jews? We will take them. But we can't just take them with nothing. We need to take some of their possessions with them. We have to have a wherewithal. Where did Herzl get this idea in 1933? Everybody knows. Moses. Moses went to the Pharaoh. And he says, let my people go. With the cattle and the sheep. So, here's the transfer agreement, and the initial thought is, we'll get rid of them. But it wasn't just in Germany, where they said, if you put your money in this bank called Paltrow, and you sell German goods, you break the boycott, and then with the money from the sale, we'll deposit the money in a bank here in Palestine called the Anglo-Palestine Bank, then you can get into Palestine around the British prohibition that says nobody gets in unless you have £1,000. Where's a Jew in Germany gonna get £1,000? He has to sell German goods. It's a real deal. Now, what is the name of Anglo-Palestine Bank today that got all these German millions? Who knows? Bank Leumi. Okay, so eventually, when America was getting close to entering the war, Hitler promised and threatened that there would be an extermination of the Jews. Now, I put that in perspective. Absolutely, the first move was to A, identify the Jews. That's IBM. Expel the Jews from society, meaning kick out all the doctors, the lawyers, the teachers. That's IBM. Three, confiscate all their monies. That's IBM. They're running all the banks. Four, ghettoize the Jews. That's IBM. One day, all the Jews pick up. The next day, everybody knows exactly where they're going. That's IBM. Five, deport the Jews. Here we get into the wartime period. They put them out on trains. Who was running the trains? IBM. 6, extermination. Auschwitz. Tattoo begins as an IBM number. You're not going to get that from the Holocaust Museum. Now, but I'll tell you this much. Listen to me. IBM consciously, for money, from the top, co-planned and co-organized the Holocaust with the Nazis in the conscious mass murder of 6 million Jews. And tomorrow morning, the American Sephardi Federation will not get a phone call from their lawyers complaining I said it. Got it? Now, let me put to you in context extermination. You think extermination? I mean, what's this word genocide? That was invented by a Polish guy at Duke University, I believe in, no, I think it was 1938. Was it 38? 38? No, it was before 38. It was before 48. No, it was already in the UN. So he took a Latin word and a Greek word and invented this word genocide. But extermination was an old method of getting rid of a people. Remember, Germany's ally, Turkey, exterminated the Armenians a few years before. And he did it along the Berlin to Baghdad Bahn. And he did it in the presence and with the knowledge of Germans. And in the newspapers, 1915, 1916, read Banking on Baghdad, the Farhud. The headlines are extermination, extermination, extermination. I think Shlomo was with me when the Turks had the big flag in the bookstore objecting to the book. And what did Hitler say? Who will remember the Armenians? Extermination was always on the table. But not everybody came to that table in 1933. They didn't come in 1934. They didn't come in 1935. But I got a New York Times front page story, which is quoted in IBM and the Holocaust, where the New York Times says the Nazis are saying they're going to get rid of 3.1 million Poles in Germany, Jews in Poland. How can this be done without extermination? It was commonly understood. The first time that I found the word extermination against Jews as a threat of the many, many, many times in Nazi literature was in 1933 in May in Liberty magazine, that they were threatening to exterminate. And remember, the Nazis were believers in the Carnegie Institution, Rockefeller Foundation theory of eugenics. And the first instruction of eugenics was that 10% of the time should be wiped out under public gas chambers. The first attempt to do so was in Ohio in 1908. And these books were studied by Hitler when he wrote Mein Kampf, and he pays tribute to them. So I've given you a very long response to a very incisive and persistent question. And now I hope you're slightly less confused than you were when I started. Is there one more, or are we done? This is the final one. Yeah, is this the final one?
Yes.
What's your name?
Yehuda.
Yehuda what?
Littman.
Okay.
There was an article in the weekend edition of the Wall Street Journal in January 2009, although it was about a different topic, about German Arabs, but there was one sentence in that article which talked about a German-Arab infantry battalion 845, a unit of Arab volunteers to the Nazi cause. How many who were these like people? Like, what country did they come from, and how many members did they have?
What was the name of the Arab unit?
German-Arab infantry battalion 845.
Well, that was probably one of the many volunteers. A division is 10,000 guys, not always. They had a 6,000-man division, a 13,000-man division. And so within a division, you have battalions, you have volunteer groups. But all these Muslim and Arab fighters wore fezes, wore Free Arabia tags, were absolutely part of the Waffen-SS, reported to Heinrich Himmler, and were part of the Nazi killing machine. And you can call them volunteers or militias, fighting units, but from the point of view of Berlin, they were important fighters who held down an important, who did an important function. They fought fiercely, and they fought fiercely because the Muslims had in their heart the desire and the goal that they would kill all the Jews of Europe so they would never get to Palestine, and the ones in Palestine would come next. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.